now for a song from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW, Painter Red by Ralph Chaplin. Come with us, you working men, and join the rebel band. Come on, you discontented ones, and give a helping hand. We march against the parasite to drive him from the land. With one big industrial union. Hurrah, hurrah, we're gonna paint her red. Hurrah, hurrah, the way is clear ahead. We're gaining shop democracy and liberty and bread. With one big industrial union. Come on, you fellows, get in line. We'll fill the boss with fears. Red's the color of our flag. It's stained with blood and tears. We'll flout it in his ugly mug and ring our loudest cheers. For one big industrial union. Hurrah, hurrah, we're gonna paint her red. Hurrah, hurrah, the way is clear ahead. We're gaining shop democracy and liberty and bread. With one big industrial union. We hate their rotten system more than any mortals do. Our aim is not to patch it up, but build it all anew. And what we'll have for government when finally we're through is one big industrial union.
Hey.
Hurrah, hurrah, we're gonna paint her red. Hurrah, hurrah, the way is clear ahead. We're gaining shop democracy and liberty and bread with one big industrial union. And now for the preamble of the Constitution of the IWW.
The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace as long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world, organized as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. These conditions can be changed, and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or a lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of a new society within the shell of the old.
Well, welcome to the WOB Radio Hour, listeners. And today around the table, we have Noah.
My name is Noah. I go by he, him pronouns, and I work in the warehouse industry, and I've been a part of the IWW since March of 21.
And we have Al, and Al is a he, him, and he's a longtime activist and wobbly. And we have a newcomer, Liz, from Bremerton, and you go by
she, her pronouns.
And what is your job description?
Early childhood education.
Wonderful. And we have Sean, he, him. And what do you do?
I'm an organizer with the Lived Experience Coalition.
That's great.
Yeah.
And this is me, Marilyn. I'm a retired mental health worker, and I go by she, they. And Lynn?
She, her. I'm a retired social worker and other things. Mm-hmm. Interpreter.
And Gordon?
Hi, my name's Gordon. I'm a retired shipyard worker and general troublemaker. I go by he, him, too. And fellow worker.
And those of you that may not know, the IWW is a union that was formed in 1905. It's the Industrial Workers of the World. What that distinguishes it from is craft unions. So, for instance, if you work for the airline, I don't care if you're a pilot, whether you're a steward, whether you're a mechanic, you're all part of the same industry. And when we organize the whole industry.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. So thank you for tuning in to the WOB Radio Hour. We're on Radio Tacoma 101.9 and 98.5 KTQA. And starting off today, we are going to jump right into our WOB Radio Hour Labor Report. We have a couple interesting topics of discussion today related to labor organizing currently taking place all around the country.
The first being, as many of you on social media have probably seen, there has been a large number of layoffs within the social media sector of the economy. Many Twitter workers have been laid off since Elon Musk took over. Facebook is planning on firing a couple thousand members of its team due to the fact that their new expansion into VR is kind of not panning out as well as they hoped. And so a lot of people that work in IT, tech, and social media in general are currently facing a lot of labor struggles because either their employers don't think that they're necessary or they don't value the labor that they do for those companies. And it's often the latter that stands louder than the former. So I think that that's very interesting because one place is where there has been recent organizing campaigns to kind of combat this has been to the social media industries. There are some smaller fledgling union campaigns, especially within like video games, animation development, IT, things like that. But we are certainly looking forward to some kind of push within larger companies like Facebook or Twitter or et cetera to unionize as well, because it's becoming more and more apparent that these workers have really been taken advantage of by their employers.
I saw a wonderful projection on the Twitter wall that said Elon Musk a worthless millionaire.
Yes, the workers are definitely getting agitated, and some people have just willingly decided to leave the job in groups and then posted on social media to say the working conditions here are terrible. You know, our employer doesn't care about our labor. Elon Musk has been very, very forward with just how little he cares about his workers. Some of them have even called him out on his platform on Twitter, being like, hey, you don't understand how the coding works. You're saying that we don't have these features when actually we do. Of course, there's the new blue check verification system, which a lot of his workers said you should not deregulate the company to the point where people can just pay to be verified, because that's a great way to have people falsely representing other individuals.
That's right.
So it is definitely interesting to see what will come of that, because at the current moment, a lot of these places are described as hot shops. So they're so... the shop environment is so toxic or so degrading or so overbearing that a lot of people are just going in and out in a revolving door kind of a situation. Fellow worker Lynn?
This is a really good example for the country to see and the world of how cruel bosses can be. But right at the holidays, they're dismissing thousands and thousands of people. What are they supposed to do with their families, with their incomes? It's just unbelievably cruel.
God damn you greedy businessmen. We hope you all drop dead.
Well said. Work.
But yeah, no, you actually, that's actually a very interesting point, because I remember hearing somebody on social media, I think it was actually on Twitter, say that people like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg kind of running these companies and making a huge profit off of it, but then showing their incompetency like this kind of breaks against the idea that being a wealthy person is out of merit or out of some kind of intelligence or education. Especially with Twitter, it's a textbook case of somebody who's hyper wealthy and has all this cool flashy stuff going on isn't exactly bright when it comes to actually knowing how to run these kinds of systems. It's the workers who know how to do that. It's the workers who have led a lot of the development, especially in the avenues of social media. But unfortunately, when orders come from the top like that, that are impossible to meet or just straight up take advantage of their employees, it kind of breaks that narrative. And I think that, going forward, that's something definitely keep an eye on. Another interesting labor report that we'd like to present is the Starbucks Red Cup Day, which took place the day before yesterday. Today is the 19th at time of recording. So Red Cup Day for Starbucks is kind of like the beginning of their holiday sale. That's usually when they offer a lot of specialty drinks and certain discounts in order to increase customer support and income. And a bunch of people who have been organizing with the Starbucks Workers Union walked off the job. I think the last recorded number I saw was 3,000 workers who worked for Starbucks walked off the job just for one day. It was like a one-day strike. And so basically what their demands from the Starbucks Workers Union is that they want Starbucks corporate to sit down with them and negotiate fair contracts, fair wages, fair benefits that they've been fighting for the past year and a half now. And so it was a really, really great way for people to get out there, even if it was just for a day, but it's on their most profitable day of the year, mm-hmm. to kind of say, hey, our job is actually taking advantage of us. It's a really tough workplace environment. And we've asked nicely for corporate to negotiate fair contracts, but they haven't yet. So we're not going to work. So there was some great solidarity all around the country at those unionized or actively organizing workplaces in Starbucks. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, our fellow workers up in Bellingham, the Whatcom Skagit IWW, the GMB of the IWW up there, they were actively working with Starbucks Workers Union. They were actually moving from store to store to see if they were open and to see if there were other pickets there. They coordinated with the people up there in Bellingham, because there's several stores, I'm given to understand. Mm-hmm. So they were moving from store to store, and I'm looking forward to a more detailed report back. But our fellow workers up there in Bellingham working with Starbucks Workers Union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the service industry, like Starbucks or other fast food chains like that. You know, they're very fast-paced environments where, you know, mistakes are easily made, injuries can be easily accrued. Of course, working in customer service means you have to deal with customers. They don't have much legal or corporate defense from people who yell at them or assault them on the job, even if they, you know, if it was an honest mistake or something like that. So, you know, I think especially in service industries, there is a lot of agitation there. And I think the Starbucks Workers Union have really capitalized on that very mm-hmm. well.
Have they not organized hundreds of shops now?
Oh, yeah. I think they've organized over 200 stores now, or at least they have won 200 union elections. There are several other stores actively organizing. Some of them are public. Some of them are still going on underground and haven't been announced yet. Of course, Starbucks has been cracking down on this. The new CEO, Howard Schultz, has straight out said in an interview, and by the way, this was an admission of a violation of labor law, that he would refuse to negotiate with the Starbucks workers unions, even if they won their union elections through the National Labor Relations Board. Obviously, labor law says that if they win a labor election like that, fair and square, you are legally mandated to negotiate with your coworkers. Or, I'm sorry, to negotiate with your employer for a contract. In this case. So, yeah. And also, Starbucks has been closing down several stores that voted in favor of a union before they could even begin contract negotiations. A couple stores were actually up in Seattle a few months ago, earlier this year. So, it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. But Starbucks Workers Union has been making some great strides. Yes, fellow worker Sean?
Yeah, another union busting technique that old Schultz has wheeled out is... one of the hiring draws for Starbucks is they provide a really good healthcare package that mm-hmm. includes transition surgery. So they've been going to employees who are attempting to unionize who also want to transition and threatening them that if you go forward with this, we're going to take your healthcare away and you're screwed. And that's a $30,000. It could be a $30,000 operation.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hostage. It's no different than holding someone captive for slavery in my mind.
I would think that some of the those employees have started down that road. In other words, they're taking other therapies. They're getting ready for this eventuality. And to be cut off in the middle is really inhumane.
What a devious tactic. As workers, we have to work to survive. So what are you going to do? Take your job or your surgery, your mm-hmm. freedom or your job?
Yep.
So yes, we'll definitely keep you in touch on what's going on with Starbucks Workers Union and the episodes ahead. The last item here on our labor report is the CNT workers who were arrested for organizing. We've covered this in, I believe, the previous episode or the episode before last in September or October. So basically, there were six members of the Spanish Confederación Nacional de Trabajo. They are a syndicalist union in Spain, and six of their members were arrested for legally organizing under Spanish labor law at a couple different workplaces. So there's been a lot of solidarity rallies taking place here in America as well as in Spain. I know that there have been protests outside of the Spanish consulate in Washington, D.C., Some IWW members were involved in that. So it's very interesting just to kind of note the kind of cross-country solidarity there between our union and the CNT supporting their workers who are currently imprisoned. Any thoughts?
Well, CNT's got a long history in Spain mm-hmm. Being at the revolutionary forefront gloriously and gallantly in the Spanish Revolution against Franco's fascists. They didn't win. but they stuck around and they went underground and they kept on organizing. So long history of the CNT standing up for the working class in Spain, and not just Spain. They're internationalists, just like the IWW, and we stand up for workers all over the planet.
In that case, that brings us to the conclusion of our IWW labor report. We will keep you in touch about the current organizing mentioned in these particular articles going forward in the episodes ahead. And now for our next section, we're going to be having a roundtable discussion talking about labor law and how we as workers can fight to change it. Fellow worker Sean, take it away.
Yeah, so we're going to start with a discussion about Glacier Northwest, Inc. versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And this is actually a case out of Washington. And what the employer is trying to do is sue the employees for, or the union, for damage done to the employer's property while the union was on strike. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to say that, well, the court, the debate for, amongst the court is going to be whether or not it's intentional or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically what this case is putting, for, at least from the employer's perspective, what the case is basically saying is that if you go on strike, or if you damage the property, or if you, you know, slow down, if you basically cause any damage to the company or the workplace during the course of a contract negotiation or a strike, then the union is going to be legally mandated to pay the employer. And we're talking about potentially charges up to the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, depending on what kind of damages they're willing to seek from the union. This could also include lost profits from a strike or a walkout or a slowdown as well. So basically this case, which I believe is currently going through the Supreme Court at the moment, basically would severely hinder unions' financial capability to negotiate contracts and go on strike and make them less likely to negotiate contracts that are more in favor of the workers, and also less likely to encourage workers to go on strike in general. So it's essentially a direct attack against workers' ability to resist their employers during such negotiations. I think that this is a very, very serious concern for anybody who has any solidarity with unions or labor rights, and it really does set a precedent for potentially the years to come when it comes to trying to organize our workplaces. As some of us here at the table already know, at least briefly, labor law in the United States has always had some deference to employers, and especially since Taft-Hartley in 1948, that deference has certainly been in the employer's hands to call the shots when it comes to punishing workers for organizing or going out on strike, as well as the collection of union dues and how contracts are negotiated, how unions are won in the workplace or the NLRB, so on and so forth. So this is just kind of one more brick in the wall of trying to obstruct unionism in general. So let's go ahead and open it up to a roundtable discussion.
Well, I'm thinking of a few things, and maybe I'm really far out in left field.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of the union being charged for damages, first of all, it's outlandish. Second of all, how do you define property? So the workers, are the workers the property of the employer?
Yeah.
Is this slavery? Are we damaging the workers' ability to work, therefore the workers, you know? Are we turning their slaves against them?
Mm-hmm.
Can we be sued for that?
I mean, it really depends on what the employer determines is damages to their company, whether that's physical property, whether that's the workers themselves, whether that's the profits. I mean, the scope of the case is not exactly closed in within certain margins. I mean, if you got accidentally injured on the job, that could be considered damages against the company if they were in the middle of a contract negotiation or a strike. If they were blocking scabs from trying to enter a work site, that could be a damage to the company's profits, which could then be damages that the union could be charged for. It's kind of an umbrella of whatever the employer says. Mm-hmm. The
pretty
union
hypothetical
did.
Stuff.
So
yeah,
depending on what lawyers they get.
Right.
In other words, the Supreme Court has just ruled that the employer has carte blanche when dealing with employees.
They didn't rule, though. It's not set to be heard until January 2023.
Well, then,
it's coming up very soon.
So the dispute is whether or not
right.
The employer can sue them.
The concern is with the current makeup of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they haven't decided, but it looks like they're going to decide that way.
Right. It's property rights versus the right to collectively organize.
That's
free assembly.
Bingo.
Right.
Or concerted action of any kind together.
Yeah. Look who's on that Supreme Court. Like last summer, they all in Cargill versus Nestle, including the progressives on the Supreme Court, okayed slavery in Mali so long as Nestle was unaware that they were enslaved workers at their cacao plant. So, like, it's not a Supreme Court that's ever been friendly to a worker since 1787, right?
Pretty much.
There was a few brief years when William O. Douglas was on the court and Justice Brandeis was on the court. There were a couple of good years, but that was the New Deal and immediate post-New Deal. They were trying to get William O. Douglas impeached. But anyway, but basically since the court was formed, since what was his name, Chief Justice Marshall? Yeah, it's been an organization to defend property and to defend the merchant class.
But yeah, no, I mean, considering the makeup of the Supreme Court now and the makeup of Supreme Courts previous, they've always, like you said, fellow worker Gordon, they have always erred towards property rights and protecting, you know, free economic trade, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And especially with the Supreme Court we have now, which is six pretty conservative members, to say the least, versus three centrists or people who might show left-wing policy support. When it comes to labor rights like this, and this case in specific regarding the Teamsters, it really does seem like, it reminds me of Roe v. Wade, where when the case to remove it went into the courts, I think most of us kind of realized that, oh, they're going to rule against it. They're going to repeal Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they're going to repeal the rights of unions to basically defend their workers during negotiations and strikes. So I think coming up in January, we're going to be facing a very interesting fork in the road as to what we can do in order to protect them.
So have we had, as a IWW union, have we had any legal advice on how to fight this?
Nothing that particularly stands out. When the Supreme Court makes a decision, it is the law of the land. It's their interpretation on the Constitution, and that applies to all 50 states.
Unless Congress were to change it.
Unless Congress were to change it, yes. So maybe, if we're lucky, Congress might take it up as an issue worth defending. But much like the Supreme Court, it's not like Congress has shown much favor towards labor organizing and unions in the first place either, unless the interests of property and profit were protected. So, yeah, I mean, there's also another interesting angle to this discussion, which is like what fellow worker Marilyn brought up, which is what exactly can we do about this? You know, do we continue going out on strikes and negotiating as hardline as we can for contracts that benefit the workers? Is there some kind of grassroots organizing that can, you know, fix that kind of situation?
There is a movement within the IWW. The IWW, let me just preface my remarks by saying IWW is a revolutionary union, but we also embrace many different diverse political opinions on the left. So there are tendencies within our union to say, well, we don't need no stinking contract. We'll just use minority unionism or solidarity unionism to get the demands we need to alleviate poor working conditions. And if we, part of our training is to have the workers inoculate themselves by knowing, well, we could get fired, but if the situation becomes intolerable, we'll go outside of that paradigm. We don't necessarily need a contract. We don't necessarily need to follow the letter of labor law, especially if it's going to become abrogated. So what I'm getting at is not illegal action. I would never suggest any of that. But what I am getting at is that you're not defeated. If you lose in court, or if the Supreme Court takes away another right, like they took away a woman's right to choose, I'm not going to be surprised by it. I'm going to be ready to organize with my fellow workers on the job site, try to find some measure of justice, some measure of relief. If they fire us, they're going to fire us all anyway. So that's just my personal take on it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that there are multiple avenues to fight back, like you said.
Sure.
I really like what you touched on with minority unionism, too, which is that even if you don't have a workplace 100% organized, you can still have a group of workers within a workplace fighting and campaigning in order to get better protections and better pay for the workers, mm-hmm. even if you haven't had a fancy schmancy NLRB election,
right.
or if you haven't, you know, marched on the boss even, you can still kind of begin that organizing so that you can make those changes. And I think that, you know, subversion from below might just be the best, one of the better strategies at least to go about it. Yes?
I have a quick comment. We've listed all the things that we can't do because of potential court cases. Here's one thing that the old guys taught me, which is work to rule. Many of us have had jobs. There's a list, and this is what you do, and this is how you do it. people who work those jobs with those lists know there's a better way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And they figure it out, and the day goes well. If your response to ill treatment is to do exactly as they tell you, it takes a long time to get stuff done,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're kind of clumsy.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, many workers in their workplaces already kind of skirt the edges of whatever regulations are in the workplace because their employers want them to maximize their labor and maximize their profit. So yes, we have rules on paper, but you're going to go ahead and disregard those rules because we need to make money. And you're definitely right that workers can take advantage of.
Actually, I'm suggesting you follow the rules absolutely.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
To the letter.
Yeah. That's what I was getting to, is that if you did follow those rules to the letter, business would slow down. It would essentially be a work slowdown by following the letter of whatever.
We're not slowing down. We're just playing by the rules.
Exactly.
And it'd be hard to bust you for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know when I did work in a factory for a while after college, the thing was, if there's a mechanical problem with the machine, you could look at it and figure it out and fix it. Or you could press the button and we'll look for some guy with a toolkit who's drinking coffee somewhere else and you can't find him. So let's all take a break.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we did.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was usually Friday nights. So.
Just to expand just a little bit on your point, mm-hmm. Noah, is that if you're in a workplace and you have a core group, which we were calling minority unionism or solidarity unionism, and maybe you have 100, 200 employees in the outfit. If you've got 10 people that are working pretty much together in unity, it's that much harder to hire 10 people all at once than it is just one person. So it has a lot of advantages. Stick together, form a bowling team, do what you need to do to be able to talk to each other.
Yeah. And actually bouncing back on another one of your points that you made previously, Gordon, we do kind of have to recognize that staying within the boundaries of labor law can only do so much.
Yeah.
And like you said, in the IWW, we don't advise nor advocate for breaking labor law. That is a very quick way to end up without a job or potentially in a court case. However, I think that doing smaller actions or building on smaller actions such as minority unionism, working to rule, or taking a break when something isn't going the way that the workers want it to go, I think that those little actions can build solidarity in a workplace or across workplaces. And even with more stringent labor restrictions coming up, like what we're hearing with the Supreme Court, I think that strategy, like I said earlier, kind of continuing the subversion despite, the official standing, is still the best way to go. I mean, yes?
Well, and also, I mean, let's be blunt, our union is about ending capitalism. So are we going to end capitalism by kowtowing to the Supreme Court for the next 50 years?
Yeah.
Another thing we could do, instead of doing small things, is build out our union even bigger and all of us get out and expand and bring more people into the union. Because if, 100,000 workers went on strike and marched on Washington, D.C., maybe Congress would codify a new law protecting us all.
Exactly. You got a point there. You got a point, fellow
worker. Yeah.
Good point.
Time to start organizing is praxis against this problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Build our ranks and confront them head on.
And in lots of different languages and in lots of different methods of communicating.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, however this court case decides to turn out, which, judging by how the court has ruled previously, I think that these new regulations on unions will go through. We should continue to organize. We should continue to act out in our workplaces however we can with our coworkers. And, hopefully that by organizing across industries the way that the IWW does, we do have a chance at meaningfully standing against this. So once the Supreme Court case gets decided, probably in our February episode, we'll keep you up to date with what has gone through and what we in the IWW are planning on doing next. So thank you so much for joining us for our labor report, and we will keep in touch with you about this and other labor-related issues going forward in the future. All right, so for our next section on the WAB Radio Hour, we're going to be discussing the acronym AEIOU. That's Agitate, Educate, Inoculate, Organize, and Unionize. It's an acronym commonly used by labor organizers to describe the steps and process of organizing your workplace for the purpose of forming a union. The particular letter today that we're going to be discussing is the letter O, standing for organizing. Organizing usually pertains to activities concerning building up a larger worker base in your workplace. Say that fast three times. in order to essentially advance the union and hopefully get to a point where you can start taking direct actions, whether that's marching on the boss, working to rule, minority unionism, or any other such concerted actions by a collective of coworkers in order to establish solidarity and essentially an organized workplace to form a union. So when it comes to organizing, usually by the time you hit this letter of the acronym, you've already had several one-on-one conversations. You have several workers already taking place in a organizing committee discussing wages, hours, conditions, and how to go forward with their next steps in building up a worker base. You, at this point, are starting to build up more and more members on that organizing committee, or getting members to participate in the organizing committee talking about how to best expand the union effort in the workplace. So when it comes to building up for direct actions, we're also talking about planning and strategizing how best to confront the boss as to shortcomings in the workplace regarding wages, hours, conditions. Such actions usually take place in the form of marching on the boss, working to rule, minority unionism if you don't make up a majority of the workplace yet in terms of those who are in favor of a union, so on and so forth. So when it comes to this particular letter of the acronym, we're really focusing on building up worker power to the point where you have a majority in the workplace and you can start to take bigger actions in order to advance the union.
Sounds like a lot of work has gone on up until that point.
Absolutely.
So you've got the numbers building.
Mm-hmm.
You've got people that are starting to use the U word.
Mm-hmm.
They know what their demands are going to be. So there's clarity happening.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, a certain amount of momentum starts to happen, and more people are drawn into and want to be part of the effort.
Right.
It becomes more attractive.
Right, right, right. Yes, Gordon?
Also, when we organize, you know, there are some real practical matters that have to be considered. We might want to start collecting people's phone numbers for a phone tree. We might want to collect some information about their home situation without being intrusive. You know, just say, okay, this person lives alone, has no car. That person might need a ride. So that kind of the nuts and bolts of organizing, communications networks, support networks, you know, a simple thing like watching somebody's dog for an hour mm-hmm. while they go to the doctor, that can be part of the organizing points and the organizing techniques and networking. So we're building relationships, but also we got to, you know, take down information about people.
Very good point.
Yeah, I mean, assessing how well your fellow workers can participate in the union effort, I think, is also a great
yep.
part of it as well.
And their vulnerabilities and their strengths.
Right, absolutely. You know, some people are good at one-on-one conversations. Some people are good at talking to coworkers about wages, hours, and conditions. Some people can help do things like prepare materials for distribution in the workplace within, you know, the legal barriers that concerns. Mm-hmm. Some workers can focus on potentially building up a social media base if the union decides to go public at this point. Usually when we're talking about the organizing step of organizing your workplace, at least within the acronym, we're talking about a union campaign that has already been going on for several months,
mm-hmm.
is still not public at this point, but plans on going public very soon in the future.
Right.
Like Marilyn said, this is talking about, you know, we already have a decent base of workers already rallying behind this. People have their roles and obligations. Now, how do we get to a point where we have either 80% of the workplace in favor of a union so that we can go forward with an NLRB election, or if we want to stick to the solidarity unionism model, which is what the IWW tends to lean for, how do we get workers agitated and rallied up so that they can start taking direct actions in the workplace? There's a couple different options there. The NLRB direction with union elections, we're usually talking about 80% of the workplace has to be in favor of voting in for a union in their workplace before the IWW gives a go-ahead to go in that direction for unionizing your workplace.
You mean the NLRB?
Well, yes. We do union elections through the NLRB if we were going to go the election route, and the solidarity unionism route is getting whatever
right.
workers are available for taking direct actions in the workplace and strategizing with them as how best to do that.
Just to make a note on what you said, fellow worker Noah, a recent exception to this general rule has panned out well. The Amazon Workers Union realized that they had too much turnover in order to accumulate what the AFL-CIO pretty much requires. You know, that they want 80% card check.
Mm-hmm.
They want to make sure that they're going to win that campaign. They don't want to waste their time and resources. They realized in their particular situation they were never going to get to 80%. And since they were an independent union, they just said, damn it, we're at the strongest point we're going to be at this moment. And they called it with, 35% of card check. And what happened is they won. They surprised everybody because the AFL-CIO said, they're never going to win because this is our experience. Well, their experience was wrong because they didn't know the conditions on the ground. So just wanted to make that note. And that's part of minority unionism. If you think you got the upper hand, go for it.
And actually, I really like that point that not everybody has to be, in the IWW's case, a red card holder in the workplace.
That's right.
In order to be 100% on board with having a union there. Sometimes it just means having enough social reach in the workplace across departments or even across the entire industry, if you're going to take a big picture, that you know that there is a workplace there that's like, you know, maybe we don't have a union card, maybe we aren't regularly taking part in meetings or strategizing or things like that, but we are in favor. Mm-hmm. And whatever help that we can provide, we can provide. Or in what you brought up earlier, which is actually having a system of mutual aid in our organizing to make sure that workers are being taken care of by those sympathetic to the union so that they can have their needs met while organizing is taking place. I actually really like that point.
I don't think you can overestimate how important that is being relevant and really getting to know your workers and what's important to them and how you can assist them in becoming more active in the organizing.
Absolutely. We touched on that previously in inoculation and agitation where, you know, you're trying to make sure that you're not only that the workers are taken care of, but that they're actually having their needs being at least in some way supported and met by union organizers.
Yeah. To further that point, in the old days when most of the workforce was male, okay, when they said working men, it was usually 95% working men. Okay, and so what the women did, they wanted to support the union as much. They formed union auxiliaries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that was a wonderful sentiment, but now we don't have to have an auxiliary because the women are fully integrated in the workforce and fully integrated in our union. And so we don't need no stinking auxiliary. We all work for each other all the time.
Right, absolutely.
As another comment, Salt of the Earth.
Yeah.
We've all seen that movie.
Mm-hmm. I have, yeah.
And was it the cops and the courts said that the miners can't do picket lines. So the women in the community did it for them.
Dolores Del Rio.
There we go. It's a great film.
It is.
Worth a good look. And it shows you the alternatives available to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually like that point as well because at this stage of organizing, you can also reach out to family members or friends of people who work in your workplace and tell them, hey, this is going on. It's not, our organizing isn't going public yet, but if you are interested in helping us, there are avenues by way you can help support the union from the outside in. And I really like that example
you provided. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, of course, the ultimate goal of this organizational step is, like I said earlier, really making sure that, you know, the solidarity is already there, or at least it's continuing to grow. But now you're kind of beginning to grow the roots, so to speak, even deeper into the workplace and even outside of the workplace to create a broad power base by which you can start directly confronting the boss. Now, in terms of direct actions, as we've seen over the past few years, you have your usual strikes. You also have marching on the boss. You also have working to rule. These are strategies at this stage of organizing that workers can begin to implement against their employers to make it known to them, this is coming towards you like a freight train. We are interested in organizing. We are demanding to have our needs met by our employer, and we have the power base in order to flex those muscles in the workplace. So I think that's something else that's also very key to this part of unionization as well, is beginning to strategize and implement direct action. That was the O of AEIOU. In our next episode coming up in December, we will talk about the final step of this acronym, which is unionization, how that takes place and what that entails. And now for our next section, we're going to be talking about Indigenous organizing and Native American History Month with fellow worker Lynn. Take it away.
Thank you. This is an article by Jeff Shantz, and it was printed in different forums, different magazines and publications, including the LA Times. It's called Bows and Arrows, Indigenous Workers, IWW Local 526, and Syndicalism on the Vancouver, BC Docks. The first union on the Vancouver waterfront was organized in 1906 by Indigenous workers. It was Local 526 of the IWW, known as the Bows and Arrows. They organized on a multicultural, multiracial foundation of class solidarity. These workers provided important and lasting examples of working class militants, workplace organizing tactics, racial solidarity, and cultural defense. Indigenous workers made up substantial parts of the workforce between 1863 and the late 1930s. The Vancouver ILA, or International Longshoremen's Association, was comprised of the Bows and Arrows, as well as mostly White Longshoremen's Union. The two merged in 1916 in Canada. They supported the One Big Union, formed in 1919, which would become highly active and influential in working class organizing in the Canadian state context, especially in Western Canada. The One Big Union would play a central role in the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919. In conclusion, Indigenous organizing is a part of the history of syndicalism, and syndicalism is part of the history of Indigenous organizing.
I think that that really kind of drives home the fact that in the context of the One Big Union, the IWW, we have always been very much adamant that we have people of all different communities coming together in order to form a broad working class power base within our union. And I think that that's a fascinating textbook example specifically of Indigenous organizing. Thank you so much for presenting that. I mean, it's certainly a piece of history that more people should know about. Yeah.
So I've got a little piece of news.
Go ahead.
She must be out of jail by now, but Winona LaDuke, who is an Indigenous organizer, I believe she's Anishinaabe, and from the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. This has to do with Enbridge Pipeline 3, I think. There's three.
Also in saving the wild rice, which is crucial to the cultural way of life. And what they have been wanting to do is lay pipeline underneath the lakes and the rice beds and destroy them.
What could possibly go wrong?
Right.
Well, she and others have been organizing to stop this, and what's the big deal now? Someone's doing an investigation to see how much money Enbridge is giving the state to pay for cops. Tear gas, tasers, I mean, the whole armament, is being funded by Enbridge, and it's trickling down to the county sheriff, so they really like the money. She went back to jail again.
Sheesh.
Several things I like about her, but one of them is her efforts on the res to unite youth and elders. That gives them both something to do. Well, you know, the aunties look after the kids, and the kids all stuff for the aunties. And that's for that tradition of ricing is handed down from one generation to the other.
Can you elucidate about that a little bit? I don't know the custom. Would they go out and gather?
Yeah. My experience is really limited. I went to an AIM conference in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and afterwards the invite went out. Let's say there was some Earth First group who had canoes, and some people paddled down the river till we came to a spot where there was a proposal for an open pit mine, and the local farmers didn't like it either, so we dragged our canoes up on the beach, and the cops came, and we had a choice, either go to jail or go back to the river, and we decided to go out for lunch and left. But it was, you know, it was just a small effort. It was like a weekend. You know, folks came up from Minneapolis, St. Paul, but it was an ongoing struggle, and I think it still continues.
Absolutely.
And there's all kinds of things to do on the res. Roasting coffee. I mean, they're small businesses, provide additional income for the people.
I really liked the part of the story where you mentioned that both the farmers and the Earth First folks and the Indigenous organizers really kind of found a lot of solidarity with this particular environmental issue.
Same hand, we all live on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and you'll like my next article.
Go ahead. Oh, yes, fellow worker Lynn?
One thing I'd like to mention, since it's Native American Month, Recognition Month, is that some reservations to this day do not have running water on them. Imagine that in 2022, that a group of people that were here before other people have no running water. And it's just absolutely mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, they absolutely face a lot of a lack of just basic resources necessary for human life.
Well,
to put it bluntly.
Part of that, though, is in the Southwest specifically, a lot of the water that would be available to them has been diverted for mining operations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they have limited water. I mean, it would be limited water anyhow, but the little bit that they've got is being polluted.
Yeah.
And we need to fight with them. You know, we really need to do solidarity union with all of these different issues. They all intersect.
Well, yeah, I mean, we should just take a cue from our own indigenous founder, Lucy Parsons, and
yes.
End capitalism. If we combine our efforts to end capitalism now, these aren't problems. We can get our land back. We can get our food back. We can get everything back.
There's a long history of indigenous organizers in the IWW, Frank Little being another example.
Yeah.
He was murdered outside of Butte, Montana for his organizing activity. But there's a lot of crossover with indigenous rights and labor organizing, because whether that's the mistreatment or the lack of equitable pay for indigenous workers, whether that's workers being able to organize to confront certain issues such as environmental degradation, a lack of resources, things like that, there's a great potential for overlap there. And I think that it needs to be stressed that that kind of work, that kind of worker power and indigenous power needs to intersect in order to make sure that those people have what they need in order to survive as a people. It's very, very important.
Well, I'm sure the listener is aware that indigenous people have been on this land for thousands of years, and they have shepherded it and nurtured it without degradation. And then along comes Europeans in their ships, and they land, and within 200 years, we have a climate catastrophe looming. So
mm-hmm.
we need to learn from the indigenous people how to better take care of Mother Earth.
Thank you so much for that, fellow worker Lynn. We really liked it. And now, fellow worker Marilyn would like to give you some brief environmental reports concerning environmental unionism, environmental issues currently facing us, such as the climate crisis, ecological degradation, and so on and so forth.
Well, I want to start with good news, and thank you, Lynn, for that very good report. Very informative. So the first little bit of good news is from the Columbia Riverkeeper. That's a magazine that comes out for the Pacific Northwest. And it's entitled Big Win for Farmers and Clean Water. The date of this is October 22nd, 2022. And the headline is Community Celebrates a Major Setback for Proposed Refinery and Rail Yard in the Lower Columbia River. In a big win for farmers and clean air and clean water, Oregon's Land Use Board of Appeals, which is called LUBA, overturned Columbia County's approval of a 400-car rail yard that would have served an unconventional diesel refinery along the Columbia, the Lower Columbia. The Columbia Riverkeeper, which is an organization, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and the local mint farmer, Mike Seeley, yay Mike Seeley, appealed the approval of the rail yard, and LUBA's decision is a major setback for Houston-based NEXT, Next Renewables, the backer of the refinery and the rail yard. They reversed, that's LUBA, reversed the county's decision and found that the rail yard was not a branch line, as the county had concluded. And so that was wonderful. Without approval of the rail yard, Next will also be unable to meet the requirements of key state permits, which require local land use authorities to be completed. So it's a big win. And many people near the proposed refinery have already expressed opposition to the Next project. And the LUBA's decision is a welcome news for these farmers and ranchers and fishers and residents in the area. And they're going to continue to stand with the community at Port Westward and its allies fighting the next ill-conceived projects that come along the pipe. So that's one thing. Those of you that have been listening for a while know that Railroad Workers United has been fighting for a while now to negotiate a decent contract that would protect the health and the safety and the medical needs of the workers. The issue is not so much pay, it's their conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been going on for weeks. They did meet with the board, and the result of that was very unsatisfactory. So at this point, they have now written a letter to Congress. We'll see what good that does.
And their proposed strike day is December 5th. So stay tuned on that. Stay tuned on that. And the reason why I'm putting this here in the environmental section is because this is an alternative to things like pipelines, to increasing gas pollution on the roads, to so many things that are contributing to climate chaos. Railroads can be a solution for that.
Absolutely. They're much more efficient in terms of fuel usage as well.
Of course they are. And so it's jobs and it's lives, because what the railroad owners, because it is a private thing, although it gets federal protection, have been willing to do is pay more, but not give them decent hours. They can be called up at any time. They had practically no sick leave. They had to plan their sick leave ahead of time. Well, how do you do that? And people were having to go to work when they were sick. That's unsafe for everybody else around the rails. And they wanted to also keep it to one human being on a rail line.
Yeah.
Sounds crazy. Incredibly dangerous.
Right. And the fight goes on there. I am very sorry, because I wanted to find that article about the dams that are going down. And there are two on the Lower Columbia, but I'm not able to pull that up right now. So I'm going to have to pass on that. But I would advise the listener to do a little Google search on the federal government ruling that two dams on the Columbia needed to come down. That's a huge win, and I'm not finding that right now.
The ones on the Lower Columbia are some of the big ones.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that block a lot of the salmon from going up the tributaries, like the Klickitat and other rivers.
I know that it's not the one that they really want to have come down, the biggest one, but it's two other ones. So it's a start. And the federal government weighed in on that, which is a huge thing.
Well, what's heartening is that they've proven that by doing these dam removals, right? Mm-hmm. And this is hoping that alternative sources of power come online quick enough, but they did it up on the Elwha.
Right.
Not too long ago.
And I've visited up there several times.
I've seen pictures. I haven't been up there yet, but it's like it's a miracle has happened. All the sediment is coming back down the river. It's forming a new delta. Mm-hmm. All the smolts are able to get up these tiny little creeks. You know, and what's astonishing to me, being a Brooklyn boy, is that these little fish can smell their way up after 100 years of not being able to get them.
Not only are the salmon coming back, but with the free flow of the river, also the clams and the oysters and the marine life down at the delta are really, really rebounding.
Are you telling me all these things are interconnected?
Well, yeah. Exactly.
That's good news.
Yeah. Does anybody else have anything they want to add to this?
I think the other thing to add to the dam removal as well is that kind of working down the food chain, so to speak. I mean, even the marine flora, things like algae, freshwater plants that grow in estuaries, those things are affected by dam construction as well.
Yeah, it's all connected.
So, you know, if the salmon is suffering, that means that the freshwater clams and smaller fish are suffering, which means that so much as the algae in the river itself is suffering. You know, I think that these dam removals will definitely help revitalize the local ecology. And like Gordon hinted on there, I think that there hopefully will be more alternative modes of energy coming. Mm-hmm. I know that Washington State does pretty decently when it comes to wind power output. Right. I know that that's another option for renewable energy.
As long
energy
as they
as well.
Don't keep pinning their hopes on hydrogen.
Yeah.
But I want to get to something else right now, which is the COP27.
Go ahead.
So here we are, they added another day to the COP27, very pretty words, very little action. And if you look at the corporate sponsors at the COP27, it's horrifying. It's a list of big oil and gas companies.
And nuclear,
yeah. So the big buzzword for this particular COP27 is restitution and damages. Mm-hmm. It looks like what we already know, the biggest contributor to climate catastrophe is our dependence on oil, the current war that Russia is waging against Ukraine. So they're invading the Ukraine because of its energy resources. And then all the countries that are helping in one way or another, whether it's the U.S. sending military equipment to the Ukraine or China or whatever that gets involved, they're all using more non-renewable resources in this war, mm-hmm. and it's like a huge rat's nest. So we need to be aware that the COP27, pretty words won't do it. Look at the country they had it in. Is that a country with democracy in mind? No, it's a big oil-producing country. All of it is corrupt, and the work is going to have to be done from pushing from below. Mm-hmm. There is more work being done outside the COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh right now by grassroots organizers, and probably nothing real is going to get done until there is no other choice. And I'm really sad to have to say that. But I think those days are coming quickly. Yes.
Well, yeah, and Pelosi spilled the beans at the last event. Someone asked her, what are you going to do about military spending on climate change, and that the Department of Defense is like the fifth largest polluter in the world. Mm-hmm. And her response without blinking an eye was, it's a safety issue. We're not going to slow down our military spending at all.
Well, you know what?
They're going to use the military to kill anyone who tries to get into this country fleeing a climate disaster. And it's bonkers, because those F-22 Raptors they're building, they pump out, like, one of those things puts out more carbon in a day of training than I can do in my entire lifetime.
Well, and climate catastrophe is a safety issue, too.
Yeah.
It's causing mass migrations, and it's causing wars and famines.
So Pelosi's response to that is, even if the military contributes to it, we're going to keep spending because we're going to need that military to defend us when climate change really becomes a problem. It's so, insanity. We're going to fight climate change with the military.
It's
the Department of Defense definitely believes in climate change.
They believe in making it happen, too.
But, I mean, they have done some things to take some action to guard against it.
They're still the fifth largest carbon emitter in the world.
Well, and you know, the last COP was the first COP where people were actually openly talking about how, this was in the U.S., U.S. military defense system was a contributor to climate change, a major one. That was the first time it was mentioned. Now it's openly being talked about. Whether anything happens in time before we all become extinct is another story.
Yeah.
But it's not very good news. Now, they have one more day, and that's today. We'll see how it goes. But it's been depressing as hell.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that, you know, we need to take whatever grassroots actions are possible in order to pressure people to do better when it comes to environmental protections and fighting against climate change. I know that the IWW has an environmental unionism caucus where we specifically talk about how workplace organizing can lead to better outcomes in terms of protecting not just the environment that workers work in, but also the environment that they live in. And so there's definitely a great intersection there between labor organizing and environmental protection as well. We've been very conscious about that in the past and still are in the present. I think another thing to touch on too is, especially in regards to, you know, grassroots actions, I think what we are beginning to see is a dialing up of the heat, so to speak, as to what's happening. You have the Just Stop Oil folks, who throwing paint on a classical painting can be interpreted by many people as being a little bit cringe. But I think that whatever way is necessary in order to bring serious attention to the issue is just what we're going to have to do. I mean, I can't remember. Somebody mentioned to me recently, actually, that this is a perfect example of saying something is treated by these large corporations and organizations. Getting together and talking about the problem is often treated as treating the problem. And I think that that definitely creates this cycle of, well, we talked about it, so we did something about it. Well, we talked about it, so we did something about it.
We call it committing to death.
Yes, committee to death. That's a perfect way of putting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so no, it is actually going to have to be actions taken by people in order to seriously lever power against powerful people in order to protect the climate.
Well, and I think we all have to get involved.
Absolutely. What are some great ways to get involved? I know that 350 Tacoma here, just down by the Port of Tacoma, is one great organization.
Yes, they're one great organization, and one of the lovely things about that is, it's cross-generational,
mm-hmm.
so young people and old people. People that have different interests that are tangential. So at the last meeting that they had, there was a person that was very interested in stopping the giant warehouse that they want to build over by Tacoma Municipal Airport that would be highly polluting, take up some of the green space that we have left, be built on an aquifer that we are going to need. The only good thing about it is that somebody's going to make big money off of it.
Yes.
So he came and presented his issue. We had people that were indigenous that came. My particular axe to grind is I was very involved in the no LNG, the giant tank they shoved down our throats. And so there's people there, all different walks, looking at what is the nexus. Where is the environmental part where we all can work together? I love 350. I love organizations like Backbone Campaign, which originally started as an organization to put the spine back in the Democratic Party with a different platform on each one of the vertebrae, but now has branched out and is really working on what they call the solutionary rail. And they are looking at the energy grid, electrifying all of the rail systems and local small source energy for little towns and cities. And they are the brilliant minds that came up with projecting things on walls of corporate buildings. So they're the ones that said Elon Musk is a worthless millionaire, billionaire. They're the ones that did that. They do artful activism. So if you like to do arts and crafts or drama, get involved. The Raging Grannies, all of these different organizations. We need to step beyond our own little silo, lend our support to other groups and unions that are doing the work. It's the only hope we got because we, the people, have the numbers.
Absolutely.
We don't have the wealth. We don't have the resources, but we have the numbers. So on one other thing that's not exactly related, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention it, the Tacoma Art Museum workers have been fighting for a better contract. And their issues are pay, their issues are medical care, their issues are safety. And they have now announced that they are unionizing. They had a meeting yesterday with the management. And they were hoping that the management, Tacoma Art Museum, would do a voluntary recognition of the union. Well, they did not. So as we're sitting here today doing WOB radio, there is an action going on today downtown across from and in the Tacoma Art Museum. The workers are demonstrating and protesting. Today happens to be the 19th of November, and you're not going to be hearing this the 19th of November. But I definitely think there's going to be actions going on for quite some time.
Absolutely.
So we couldn't be there because we're doing this show. But please be aware that Tacoma Art Museum workers are actively organizing and lend them your support.
Fellow worker Marilyn, do you know who they're lining up with?
I believe that they're doing AFSCME.
Okay.
Yes.
Their state.
I didn't know it was a public thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's not a bad outfit.
Right, and part of the issue is we all know that the word nonprofit doesn't mean non-corrupt.
That's right.
And so it's a nonprofit, but that doesn't mean that the workers have to starve.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for that report.
Yeah.
And now to give us an update from the Kitsap Labor Notes is fellow workers Sean and fellow worker Gordon. Feel free and take it away.
Greetings, fellow workers and fellow listeners to KTAH's Wally Radio Hour. We're going to give you a couple of views from that wonderful strange land across the Narrows Bridge, Kitsap County, Bremerton, and vicinity, as far as the IWW perspective is concerned. And to kick it off, we've got a pretty good report back, and fellow worker Sean's going to let us know what was going on.
Yeah, so on November 12th, a local collective organized a benefit show for Food Not Bombs, which is an organization that seeks to protest war by feeding people. And not just doing it in a let's talk about it sense. They actually source discarded food from around the Kitsap area, prepare meals with it, and then eat the meals with houseless folks on MLK Way in Bremerton. Along with them were the benefit shows for Pacific Harm Reduction Alliance. It's a group of folks that help people get off drugs by harm reduction, which is a very compassionate, helpful way to get off drugs. So on the 12th, we all, four bands got together and played a show for about 3 hours. And then it was rather loud. And then seven radical orgs showed up and tabled with free magazines. The IWW was there next to the mosh pit, giving away copies of Think It Over, One Big Union, and The Seattle Worker. And in total, we raised over $1,500 in gifts and donations. And then,
just to expand on that, the money that... Okay, you could get into the venue by bringing a bag of food or a bag of clothes. And what happened is that there were so many donations of clothes. It was made note of the next day on the Signal platform. The cash donations, it was advised $8 might be a good donation to get in. And they had enough money to actually pay the bands and pay the technicians and pay the venue. It's not a public venue. It is not supported. Bunch of anarchists, really. So it's not supported by anything except mutual aid. And it was a great example of that.
Well, and it's born out of an organizing principle we're embracing up in Kitsap, which is people need to know about the left to join it. We just can't be sitting at home talking about academic issues and theory and all that stuff. We have to be in the streets, visible for people to show that the IWW and the left is offering material solutions to your problems. And so we were there, and about 100 people showed up, and a lot of them weren't aware that the left had things to offer them in Kitsap County. So it's really positive.
Yeah, and we're working with other groups. We're not just being doctrinaire about only labor organizing. We concentrate on that. We've got a lot of good ideas kicking around out there amongst the people who are closest to the streets, and a lot of them want to organize into perhaps co-ops or perhaps a workers' collective, and so we're kicking those ideas around. We don't want to blow any of our plans, but what's going on is a great deal of education and outreach in Kitsap County, and we're having a moderate amount of success.
Sounds like fun. I wish I could have made it up there to go join you folks. I know that there's a few couple punk bands playing at that benefit concert as well, and I've been kind of getting into the genre myself, so sad I missed out, but it sounds like there was great turnout.
Well, there's ongoing stuff, and fellow worker Sean has a good rapport with the people who own the venue, and we have an open invitation to table there for IWW for any event.
Sounds like we'll have to take advantage of it soon.
The collective that organizes this is looking to do a benefit show a quarter. The next one is going to be for an indigenous group, and we're looking to go bring in the 1876s. They're like an indigenous punk band. They're a lot of fun. So one of our organizers, Billy, who's also a WOB, is going to go down to Olympia and see them on the 3rd. So hopefully we'll have another show to advertise.
Mm-hmm.
Good work.
Well, thank you so much for providing that report. We certainly look forward to hearing more about what comes out of that wild little peninsula that you both live on. And hopefully there will be more IWW events that we can, pitch in and help support the workers out there. Thank you so much.
One big union, fellow worker.
One big union.
So speaking about helping out other groups, on December 8th, the Home in Tacoma for All group, which is a subcommittee and a consortium, but primarily organized by Democratic Socialists of America, good outfit, is having a concert. And the purpose of the concert is raising money for housing justice. And they'll be featuring the Rusty Cleavers, Cellophane Eyes, and KPX. It will be at Alma in Tacoma. Doors open at 7 o'clock. All ages. And you can find more information at Tacoma4all.org, December 8th.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Marilyn. All right. Now, closing out the show, we'd like to finish off with a section talking about the Centralia Tragedy Memorial. There was a couple fellow workers, Mike and Mary, down in Centralia, who have been
Garrison, who have been campaigning
for a long time to have a memorial built in downtown Centralia for the Wobblies who were persecuted as a result of the Centralia tragedy. The Centralia tragedy, as we've talked about previously in last year's episode in November, what happened was a bunch of American Legionnaires were spurred on by the local lumber barons and interests in the Southwest Washington region to crush the IWW Union Hall in Centralia because they saw their organizing as a direct threat to their profits and business expansion. So on Armistice Day in 1919, what we now call Veterans Day used to be Armistice Day, and on Armistice Day in 1919, immediately after the First World War, a bunch of American Legionnaires rushed the Centralia IWW Hall in downtown Centralia to essentially forcibly evict the Union from town. Multiple members were arrested as a result of that raid and were tried and imprisoned for crimes, for the crime of defending their Union Hall with force, essentially. And one IWW member, Wesley Everest, he managed to successfully flee the hall during the raid and was pursued by another Legionnaire with a firearm. And Wesley shot and killed him because he was cornered, I believe, at some creek or river. And he believed that the
Skookumchuck.
At the Skookumchuck River. And he shot the Legionnaire because he legitimately believed that he was going to kill him. He had a gun in his hand. And what happened to him was that he was pulled out of jail after all the Wobblies were round up. They were thrown in the town jail. Wesley Everest was first beaten in the daytime, almost lynched in the daytime, until a passerby, an elderly woman, told the crowd not to do it. They threw him in jail with his other Wobblies. Later that night, a whole crowd of people cut off the power to the town and had Wesley dragged out of his jail cell and lynched underneath a railroad bridge just outside of Chehalis. So we commemorate the persecution and the loss of Wesley Everest and the other Wobblies in Centralia on November 11th of every year.
I know that Gordon has some things he would like to add to that.
Just to say that to this day, the town is still pretty much divided about the events that happened that night.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, people are arguing about the accuracy of it. But what I would like to emphasize is that sometimes it takes the ultimate sacrifice, if you will, to help the working class become liberated. And Wesley Everest surely did pay that price. And he was still in partial uniform. He had been drafted into the United States Army. So he's a United States Army veteran, for all you veteran lovers out there, as am I. Okay, just so you know. I get pretty touchy when people wave the flag in my face and thank me for my service when they know nothing about what happened. And it's all it is just idolatry. So what I'm saying is, just because we're veterans doesn't mean we're immune to getting persecuted by the forces of reaction. And I'll get off the soapbox right now.
Well said, Gordon.
And Al, do you have any history that you want to add to this?
A little bit. I think this is how it went. Many, many years ago, the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association had a big whoop-de-doo in Centralia. They brought in academic explainers explained it to us. And we went from Centralia to Montesano, where the trial was held. There's lots of problems with that. The army was camped in the front yard of the courthouse.
And that's clear intimidation.
Just to intimidate the jurors. And by the way, after the trial was all over, many jurors said, well, you know what, we kind of changed our mind. They're maybe really not guilty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that was after the fact. The guilty verdict, as one professor explained, they were accused, and I need to follow this up, I suppose, they were accused of conspiracy to commit second-degree murder. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Right, yeah.
We all know, first degree is you planned it. Conspiracy is to plan stuff. But they didn't really plan stuff, they just did it. Elmer Smith was disbarred.
Right, that was their attorney.
Right.
He was disbarred for life.
Yep. I think 11 men went to Walla Walla.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Where they spent years until they were pardoned or released.
A few died, right?
I think so.
One died.
And then there was one guy who said, I'm not leaving until you forgive me, or you say we're sorry.
Yeah.
And let me go, because we did nothing wrong.
He was the last one to be released in 1938. Mm-hmm. So from 1919 to 1938. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's a common thing you notice in any oppression in America. The conservative Elks Club, Legionnaires, whoever, murders the lefty,
the city rallies around them.
And builds a statue.
To the murderer. And then they charge the victims with inciting a riot that got themselves killed.
Or in this case, conspiracy to commit second-degree murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see that when slaves before the Civil War uprise, you see that in the labor uprising.
Well, women certainly know that.
Yeah.
You know, if you weren't wearing that particular outfit, you wouldn't have gotten raped. It's all your fault.
Yeah.
And the crime of being black, like George Floyd, it's well known and it's been going on since the country began.
Yeah.
And it's up to us to change.
Up to the powerful, you're the oppressor now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in regards to recent news, fellow workers Mike and Mary Garrison down in Centralia have been rallying the city government to commemorate a plaque in downtown Centralia to the IWW members who were persecuted and to Wesley Everest, who was lynched as a direct result of that tragedy. And I was actually there at that city council meeting earlier this month to discuss what exactly the plaque would entail, what the details of it would be, where it would be placed. And to the complete surprise of everyone, the motion to commemorate that plaque passed 7-0.
Which
entire city council unanimously voted in
favor of it. Which is huge, because Mike and Mary and the IWW have been working on that for years and years and years.
Yes.
We were hopeful that it would happen on the 100th anniversary.
Yes.
But it happened on the 103rd?
And an odd twist that I was not aware of, but F.W. Tuck says the most opposition from the plaque has come from the local Labor Council?
Yes. Yes. There was two.
Chair hates the IWW for some reason?
Well, he's a legionnaire.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh,
no legionnaire ever did anything like that.
The irony. Specifically, his one objection, that gentleman's one objection, was that the IWW logo should not be on the plaque. And so Mike, Mary, and I kind of raised a stink about that and said, no, this is a commemoration to members of an organization who are specifically targeted, specifically harassed, faced violence. One of them was murdered in the cold blood of night. Like, no, this is the organization that happened to. We're going to keep that on the plaque. And the city council was like, well, yes, it should be on the plaque. That's who was being targeted. That's the history of the event. So it is going to be placed a short distance from the Sentinel statue in downtown Centralia, which commemorates four members of the Armistice Day parade who were shot by IWWs. I believe one or two of them were actually involved in the raid or reacted to the raid happening. I'm sure I could talk about that for ages. Like you mentioned, you know, there's a whole bunch of history and back and forth as to what exactly happened.
More than just a raid, because the year before, the IWW hall had been invaded and smashed.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, they tore it up.
Yeah, that's a little different than raided.
Absolutely.
And Wesley was a Pacific Northwest boy who was radicalized here and was an IWW organizer. He was specifically sent there to organize Centralia.
Absolutely.
They specifically planned to kill him.
So
the design of it, I saw the mock-up, and it's beautiful.
Yes, it will be brass. It should be on some kind of concrete block to add an angle.
Mm-hmm.
It will be it's going to be right next to the Sentinel. To those of you who are familiar with Centralia, or at least this park, there's a library, and then there's a Sentinel statue in the center of the park, and the plaque is going to be between the two.
Oh, excellent.
On a raised angled pedestal. The only issue right now is that the city government said, you can build it here, but the IWW has to fund it entirely. The estimate for constructing the plaque and the base and the actual implantation of that marker monument is going to be somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000, depending on how it pans out. So we are going to be giving you updates, hopefully here in the near future, about fundraising events, building up the funds in order to have this plaque constructed. So we are definitely going to keep you in the news about that. But we are very happy to have some kind of commemoration okayed by the city where it happened for the IWWs that were persecuted as a result of the tragedy.
Big shout out to Mike and Mary Garrison.
They're the best.
Long-term IWWs and dedicated to the cause of the liberation of the working class. Thank you.
All right, yeah, absolutely. Closing out the show today, in terms of conclusion and general housekeeping, does anybody have anything else they'd like to throw in?
Just one thing, just to mark a shout out to mark the passing of a great comrade and fellow worker, Staunton Lind, a famous labor writer and historian and organizer out of the Youngstown, Ohio area.
and he has just passed, and I recommend that you read Stoughton Lind, L-Y-N-D, and he's had several co-writers to get a good picture of what it's like to try to organize workers in the United States.
The IWW store has a fantastic book that he co-wrote with another gentleman, Andre Gabrasik, I believe his name is.
Gerbichik.
Gerbichik is how his name is pronounced. It's called Wobblies and Zapatistas, yeah, and it's talking about anarchism, Marxism, and different working class movements over the 20th century, and how many different aspects of those intersect in terms of common problems that they seek to face, and how there was kind of an overlap of different ideological movements over time.
So, as a fellow worker, Al and I had the opportunity to watch this young man speak, and he's from where, Serbia or no, Bosnia.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's from Bosnia, went through the whole thing back then. He had some very interesting stories, lucid, and he can explain the left from the independent or anarchist point of view.
And say his name again.
Gerbichik.
Gerbichik.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andrei Gerbichik.
Andrei Gerbichik.
Well, I want to say presente.
Oh, yeah.
The other book is
The Labor Law for the Rank and File.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah. Then the pamphlet about Starbucks, too. He co-authored the... Yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. We just had it.
Well, we could just go on for hours.
All of the above were all members of the IWW.
See, I didn't know that he had joined up.
Well, Andrei said that this morning, that right on my phone.
Oh, okay, cool.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Soy el compañero Miguel y estás escuchando WAB Radio Hour, producido por el sindicato radical, el IWW, Trabajadores Industriales del Mundo, desde Tacoma, Washington. Hoy hablaremos un poco sobre Joe Hill, uno de nuestros miembros en el principio del siglo XX. Un día como hoy, el 19 de noviembre de 1915, Joe Hill, sueco-estadounidense, miembro del Sindicato de Trabajadores Industriales del Mundo, IWW, y compositor, fue ejecutado por un pelotón de fusilamiento por un asesinato que la mayoría de los historiadores creen que no cometió. A lo largo de su vida, Hill escribió muchas canciones como There is Power in a Union, Casey Jones, The Union Scab, y The Preacher and the Slave. Esta última canción es el origen de la frase Pie in the Sky, prometida por los predicadores a los trabajadores hambrientos. Comerás, adiós, adiós, en esa gloria tierra sobre el cielo. Trabaja y reza, vive del heno. Tendrás pastel en el cielo cuando mueras. En la última carta de Hill al líder de la IWW, Bill Haywood, escribió, adiós, Bill. Muero como un verdadero rebelde. No pierdas el tiempo con el luto. Organízate. También le dijo a Haywood, no quiero que me encuentren muerto en Utah. Y pidió que lo incineraran y que sus cenizas se utilizaran para reponer la tierra. A su funeral en Salt Lake City acudieron grandes multitudes que fueron descritas como una turba asesina de extranjeros de poca monta por el periódico Ogden Standard Examiner y como anarquistas, nihilistas, socialistas, terroristas y vagabundos por el New York Times. En 1936, Alfred Hayes y Earl Robinson escribieron una canción sobre Hill en la que describen su espíritu, que perdura. Soñé que veía a Joe Hill anoche, vivo como tú y como yo. Digo yo, pero Joe, llevas 10 años muertos. Nunca morí, dice él, nunca morí, dice él. Desde San Diego hasta Maine, en todas las minas y fábricas, donde los trabajadores se declaren en huelga y se organizan, es allí donde encontrarás a Joe Hill. Es allí donde encontrarás a Joe Hill. Ese fragmento fue tomado del sitio web Working Class History, Historia de la Clase Trabajadora. También queremos recordar otros dos eventos históricos del IWW, que ambos sucedieron en el estado de Washington, pero en distintas fechas. El primero fue la masacre en la ciudad de Everett, el 5 de noviembre de 1916, y la otra masacre en la ciudad de Centralia, el 11 de noviembre de 1919. En ambos eventos, los Wobblies, o los miembros del IWW, fueron atacados violentamente, resultando en varios muertos y varios presos. Gracias por oír nuestro programa hoy. Desde Tacoma, Washington, saludos.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on 101.9 Low Power FM and 98.5 Low Power FM. We certainly look forward to you joining us on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. and 11 p.m. for the WAB Radio Hour. Thank you so much for joining us.